Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 15th of September. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Charles Archer.
Autumn is truly here, gents. It's a bit nippy out there. And it really does feel, I guess it's only a matter of weeks until we have to turn the central heating on. Probably some people have already done it because the mornings are cold. Not really something that you're thinking of, I guess, right now, Kev?
No, I've got no AC in my office yet and I'm sweating like a pig. But yeah, other than that, it's wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you it's gone cold, hasn't it, Charles? Morning.
It's so cold. It's so cold. And also, right, genuinely, I was on the beach 2 weeks ago. I was on the beach drinking cocktails. And now I'm looking at the central heating console. I'm like, no, November. No, that's when we turn it on in this house.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, by the time you're listening to this, I will be in by the Mediterranean again, because I'm going back up to my house in Martha Matrua. So yeah, it's a bit cooler up there. It'll be 28, 29 degrees.
They're saying actually next week here, like Monday to Thursday, it's going to be 21, 22. So have an Indian summer as it is. Let's hope so, because it's been pretty dreadful so far.
It's actually normally the nicest time in the UK when you do get a bit of an Indian summer in September. Yeah. It's beautiful. Especially no kids, so everybody's at school and, you can actually enjoy the time. But yeah,
absolutely. So we've got a veritable feast of guests coming up on today's podcast. So let's get started on the news stories which have dominated the headlines this week. I guess on the subject of heating and energy costs, the big news story this week was that MPs have voted to restrict winter fuel payments to only the poorest pensioners in England and Wales, with 348 votes in favour and 228 against. A significant number of Labour MPs, I think it was 52, abstained from the vote, including some vocal critics of the plan. Conservative MPs opposed in the move, arguing it would harm millions of elderly and vulnerable people, while Labour defended it as a necessary fiscal measure, with Work and Pension Secretary Liz Kendall emphasising the increases in the state pension would offset this loss. Despite the low active rebellion, the higher number of abstentions reflects discomfort within Labour ranks over the policy. Is Labour falling apart on this news, Charles?
I think it could become the Lib Dems tuition fee fiasco for Labour. I mean, taking the heating away from pensioners does feel pretty unfair.
Draconian, isn't it?
It is, but then it's not. I mean, like, it depends. I think the problem is that there's so much wealth inequality among retired people in the UK. I'm uncomfortable, for example. I pay a lot of tax. I mean, we all do. Anyone domiciled in the UK earning decent money, I'm uncomfortable with it going to millionaires who have retired with houses they bought the peanuts back in the day. Yeah. At the same time, there are going to be people who don't get the winter fuel allowance, who like are just outside of, you know, pension credit. And so these people are going to suffer. And I just think it's why are the Labour government putting so much effort into this? It makes no sense to me at all, just from like a maths perspective. So
and then they announced that the funding for
why don't they give it to all the poorest and then allow the people who need it to apply for it? Because the millionaire's not going to apply for 300 quid.
Yeah, I don't know. But then even the application...
Or is that just too much because it ends up costing £1,000, £2,000 in administration costs just to do it?
Well, it's a 143-page form or something along those lines. I mean, like, perspective, right? The OBR forecasts the UK public spending for 2024-25 is £1,226 billion. The black hole is £22 billion that they keep talking about. That's 1.8% of, you know, annual spending. And this taking away the heating, the winter fuel allowance, it will save £1.4 billion. So we're talking, you know, in the annual percentage terms, this is nothing. This will do nothing to the, you know, if you've got £1,000 in your pocket, this is the equivalent of, you know, a couple of quid maybe, and not even that. So yeah. I don't know why they decided to risk all their political capital.
I know they've sort of died on the hill, haven't they, of this particular thing. But is it more a point of proving how badly the Conservatives, dealt with the economy? It seems to be more of a political game than it is an actual reality. Because as you say, Charles, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a huge amount. But they are trying to prove, in my point or my view, that they are fiscally responsible. Yeah. And therefore, in the longer run, that will get them longer, as in another term or whatever. They are thinking longer.
Yeah, I was reading the paper, and there is very divided the thoughts on it. I mean, one person wrote in saying, well, 60% of pensioners don't need it. They've got plenty of cash. They've got savings. They should have budgeted better when they were younger in terms of paying into their own private pensions. In fact, wait a minute, what's the name? Kevin Hornsby, Egypt, is it? Kevin Hornsby, Cairo, I think, sent that one in. I mean, your thoughts on it. You made it clear last week, didn't you, that you think that they should have had more responsibility in terms of, budgeting for the future and things like that.
Well, I wouldn't say it was budgeting for the future, but the reality of the situation is, as you've said, a huge number of the people don't need this £300. It was like, I have multi-millionaire people that I speak to who are going to get it. And it's like, what? But the people who are going to get it are the ones that are in the system. Now, maybe there are some that aren't in the system that aren't going to get it. But it's a political hot potato, isn't it? So it's been used now as a football, if you like, to say, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to it? And ultimately, the people who are going to lose it would have voted for who?
Conservatives, they're older.
Okay, so, it is also we're going to look after
You've
others.
got a lot of those coming out now who voted Labour on different premises and saying straight away, I'll never vote Labour again because of this winter fuel cut. So there is a massive amount of, aggression towards them. So, but let's have a look over the pond. I mean, obviously, it's all been about the Harris-Trump presidential debate. Kamala Harris effectively put Donald Trump on the defensive throughout the 90-minute clash, repeatedly rattling him with personal attacks on his past actions, such as his conduct during the Capitol Hill riot and his rally sizes. While Trump tried to respond, often getting off topic, Harris kept him from focusing on his strengths, such as the economy. A CNN snap poll and betting markets indicated that Harris performed better, with the sharp jabs keeping Trump off balance and a messaging resonating on key issues like abortion and tariffs. So what do you make of the first of the 90-minute debate?
I think it's very interesting now that the way that the press are actually covering these debates, because the debate and the upshot of the debate is basically being covered by, Kamala Harris's friends. And even the whole debate itself seemed very not against Trump, but it was basically giving Kamala Harris the opportunity, especially with the questions and the things that were asked, the chance to do the 1-2 on Trump. So I think what comes out of all of these things is that we have to understand that we are being manipulated by the press, whichever way somebody wants us to go. Okay. And that's whether that's social media, whether that's the press itself, whether it's US, UK, doesn't really matter. We are being manipulated by these things. So I'm not so worried about Trump, Harris. I'm worried that we can't just see the thing as it is anymore. It just doesn't seem to be possible, and it may well have been that they sided with Trump because they wanted Trump. But in this case, in my view, having listened to a few podcasts about it, the slant towards Harris and the slant on social media towards Harris is phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal that people are being pushed that way.
It's
I
a
don't know.
good
What do
point.
you think, Charles?
Oh, I think based on that, like you say, there's two issues. With the debate, it was pushed towards Harris, wasn't it? It was she was given the easier questions, she was given the opportunity to attack Trump more. At the same time, Trump's performance was pretty terrible. But I do take your point. I think the problem is now that everybody has bias. Nobody has like an independent opinion when it comes to politics. And this is true of pretty much all journalists now. And it used to be the case, for example, the BBC is a classic example in the UK. Is meant to be a completely independent and impartial broadcaster. And yet, how often does it feel like that's just not the case? And whoever happens to be writing the article or doing the interview has their own opinion. I don't know. I don't know. I think it's becoming harder and harder to get independent news. And I guess the only thing that you can do to protect yourself from that is to read as many sources as possible. I like a good thought experiment, I think, is quite fun. Something happens in the news that's major. Read the Guardian's take on it in the UK and read the Daily Telegraph's take on it, and they'll use exactly the same facts and have completely different opinions, and then you can work it out for yourself.
Then go somewhere in the middle of that, and it might be a
Closer
fairer
to the truth,
yeah, absolutely.
well,
So,
I
I
mean.
mean, you make a good point on that, Kev, about the social media aspect, because who actually announced her endorsement for Harris this week? Did you see that news?
Sure, she'll shake it off.
So I'm sure she'll shake it off. Yeah, Taylor Swift. She on Tuesday after the presidential debate, she wrote on Instagram, "I will be casting my vote for Kamala Harris and Tim Walz in the 2024 presidential election. I'm voting for Kamala Harris because she fights for the rights and causes I believe need a warrior to champion them." And the last time she posted a register to vote link on her Insta story, 35,000 people signed up. So there is absolutely no doubting her influence. And the original Insta post that she put out on Tuesday has now gone up to 10 million likes. So do you think it's possible that she could sway the vote with the millions of young sort of adolescent followers?
I think it is possible. The amount of power that you have, that Taylor Swift has. I mean, she moves the GDP of countries. She moves when interest rates are going to change. And one really important thing to understand about American politics is that the presidential elections are won in a few handful of, four or five swing states, and those states are themselves won by sort of, tens of thousands of voters. So you don't need to have particularly much influence in terms of absolute numbers to change the outcome of an election. Now, if you were to ask anyone before she made an official, something official on Instagram, who Taylor Swift would probably support over Trump or Harris, 99% of people would know that she'd say Harris anyway, but it's the fact she's given her political backing to a candidate. And this opens up all sorts of questions about to what extent people in entertainment or sport should be open about their politics. Because, yes, you can have your own opinion, but you're also massively influencing what people are going to do. And the problem is that, people like us who follow politics and finance closely have our own minds, I would say. And we all disagree on stuff all the time, right? But if you're someone who doesn't follow it closely and then, Taylor Swift tells you to vote one way, you might just vote without paying attention to anything else because Taylor told you to. And that's kind of terrifying because everyone's votes are equal.
No
No comment
comment.
from Kev. Okay.
No
Well, that's
comment in
good.
terms of the celebrity side of things. I mean, when you look at the different celebrities that have supported, whether it be Trump, whether it be Harris, it's I don't know, it's not 50-50 because Swift obviously moves the needle, but there's quite a few come out for Trump. There's quite a few come out for Kamala Harris, who has never been voted into anything.
No.
But the
And
mad thing is,
now
you make a really good point again that about the political influence. I mean, I was reading a really interesting article about George Clooney and how influential he was in making Biden step down in the New York Times. I don't know if you read it, but it was unbelievable. He was almost begging him to step down, and he actually did. Like a day later than when it was published, he did came out and announced his stepping down. So he does have a massive influence. And a lot of these stars, you'd be surprised. I think she will get a lot of people, youngsters in particular, to who weren't maybe thinking about voting to actually register, and that could be crucial in some of these swing states.
well, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger, right? Famous actor and then governor of California. Donald Trump, most famous for his part in Home Alone 2, before he got into politics. I think this kind of pipeline from sort of acting and musician and popularity, this kind of entertainment sector going into politics, I think it's going to get bigger and bigger in America because of the nature of the electoral system means that you only need to win those swing states. And it's tapping into a new source of political capital. I mean, when we talk on like the small cap market, one of the challenges that companies are finding, not Greatland Gold, for example, whatever, but most companies are finding it's harder to get capital on the markets. And in politics, it's the same because in America, 95% of people have already decided they're going to vote for Trump or Harris years ago. And so you're going after that 5% of swing voters, and that celebrity endorsement can change what people think.
Maybe we get the Oasis Brothers in the UK then shortly,
I'm sure
and
one will choose
see.
Keir and one
All
will choose
right, our
Richie.
kids, see whether we can get this sorted out and get this country back to where it's supposed to be.
I didn't realize they were Scousers.
Yeah, well, I'm not very good with the Mancunian accent. I apologize and give you a Scouse accent all day, but not a bit of a Manchester one. But anyway.
Okay, well, we've talked long enough on politics and news. Let's move on to our first guest this week, Sean Day, Managing Director of Greatland Gold PLC. Sean has played a pivotal role in leading the company through significant milestones, most recently overseeing a $325 million equity raise to acquire full ownership of the Havieron and Telfer gold copper projects in Western Australia. This transformative deal, valued at $475 million, positions Greatland as a major player in gold and copper production. Sean's leadership has been instrumental in securing strong investor backing, including support from major shareholders like Wyloo Investment, and guiding the company toward long-term success in the mining industry. We're excited to have him here to share more about this journey. So welcome, Sean. I feel like I'm amongst royalty now.
Thank you, Phil and Kevin and Charles as well. Really appreciate you guys taking the time to catch up. Yeah, you've been long supporters for a while now, and yeah, it's really good to then talk about what we've just achieved.
Absolutely. So I mean, tell us more about this transformational deal, Sean. Can you walk us through the significance of acquiring the full ownership of Havieron and the Telfer project? What was the strategic thinking behind this $475 million deal?
Yeah, it's a great question, and really this just goes back to the start. Yeah, I think Greatland and you know, you would recall Callum Baxter deserves all the credit in the world for that original Havieron discovery. You know, for whatever confluence of reasons, they then went into a joint venture with Newcrest, where Greatland demoted itself to a 30% non-controlling stake. And from that time, we no longer controlled our own destiny. And I think my attraction to joining Greatland, and I think I've spoken about this openly really over the last few years, was potentially there was an opportunity to buy this back from a global major, to have a mid-cap owner who was laser-focused on the potential and could deliver Havieron and leverage the existing Telfer assets. And that's what's so pleasing with today's or this week's transaction, is that we've been able to deliver that vision and take back full ownership and control of the Havieron development together with them. And now it's this confluence with this existing free cash flow generation from Telfer. So yeah, it's a really good platform that we have, and it's accelerated us to an immediate, meaningful producer of gold copper, plus this 20-year mine life that's augmented with at Havieron. So it's a beautiful asset suite we now own.
Absolutely, yeah.
So we need to take a picture of Sean's face here just as he smiles, because though he's tired, he obviously realizes what a great deal he's managed to do. So just focus on Sean's face.
So, I mean, to raise $325 million in this current market, I mean, companies are struggling to raise $1 million or £1 million in this, you know, in this AIM shitty market as it's been defined. But how did you manage to secure such a strong investor backing, especially with the major support from the likes of Wyloo Investments?
Well, and it's the 325, another 168 that we issued to Newmont, plus another, you know, say 10 US without doing the conversion through the retail mechanism. So look, it was a lot, but what we've done is actually for every share you own in Havieron or in Greatland, you actually now own a greater portion of Havieron. So you actually own more of Havieron today, plus a share of Telfer, which you didn't own yesterday. So this is accretive, and economic theory, yeah, would tell you that, or investment theory would tell you accretive acquisitions are a good idea. So, but how do we get that support? Look, we had to share our vision for this platform. And I think a management team, and I've assembled, you know, just some tremendous operators who were friends and colleagues of mine at Northern Star over a prolonged period, where we have this shared understanding of buying assets off majors, successfully completing an integration, focusing on achieving improved productivity, reinvesting in the drill bit to extend mine life, and then returning value to our shareholders. And I think the market could see the wonderful asset base there. This is a huge endowment, could see the infrastructure already in place, but then also to have a management team that had achieved similar in the past gave the market a huge amount of confidence. And look, not only I'm delighted to have had that support in what, as you described, a difficult market, we raised significantly more than our entire market cap, but it was humbling to receive that support, and yeah, so appreciative to have this opportunity.
Yeah, it's a very good point you make, Sean, that effectively now 100% of Havieron, we had 30% of Havieron and GGP, so there's maybe double the number of shares going to be an issue, but you have three times the asset in terms of Havieron, and you also now have processing facilities. So I presume that's going to help in terms of the whole capex required to make Havron work. But one of the questions I was going to ask as a starting point was, how much had Newcrest and Newmont actually spent in the ground already in Havron?
Yeah, look, it's an interesting question, but in some ways, we've taken a circuitous route to the development of our Havron asset. But what's remarkable by taking this circuitous route through ownership of Newcrest and eventually Newmont, not only have we expedited that development, but over 380,000 metres have been drilled into this ore body. The decline has been advanced, and that spending is in the realms of $500 million. So it's been actually a wonderful way to achieve, has been to have the support of the major and now kind of earn it back for ourselves. And I mean ourselves in the Greatland shareholder group, and then being able to deliver. So although there were some twists and turns on the way, this has been perhaps the best way we possibly could have managed a discovery and taking Havron into production.
So really what you're saying is more money has been spent already on Havron than actually the whole deal has cost to put into.
Sorry, I might have been, I think, in Australian dollars, so maybe think more in Australian dollars when I say that. But it's still in the ballpark, and you get all the infrastructure of Telfer
of and Telfer,
the immediate free cash flow of its production.
Yeah,
I think that's a pretty valid point.
Yeah, I suppose that was the next point, really, is that the production side of things, based on the documents that I've read in the presentation, you're looking at Telfer with, I think, 1,468 all-in sustaining costs on the ore that's already there, and with a gold price of 2,580, 2,590 US and over 3,800 Australian dollars per ounce of gold. Could you have imagined that 2 years ago?
I could imagine it. It's nice to then deliver it. But that's been, you know, my vision for this platform all along. But, you know, as you described, the SRK report has over 426,000 ounces in an established 15-month mine plan. I think it's actually a $1,454 US all-in sustaining cost. As you described, a gold price in excess of $2,500. It's $1,000 US margin per ounce.
Yeah.
Over 426,000 ounces.
So on that, Sean, you don't mind me jumping in. Havieron, 8.4 million ounces of resource. All-in sustaining costs, $818 US dollars per ounce. You're looking at $2,500 plus gold price. 258,000 ounces a year. I mean, anyone who's got a calculator can work out it's hundreds of millions of dollars from 2027. I mean, my basic perspective is how did you get this deal at such, you know, in my view anyway, a low valuation for the assets that you've bought from Newmont?
Look, I think we had a unique position as an existing joint venture partner. There was this last right of refusal within the documentation.
Yeah.
Coupled with that, I enjoy a really close relationship with the Newmont team, and they've wanted to be good custodians of this asset. They've continued to invest in Telfer, particularly during this period. They want that team to come across, those people that they care about, who, at least for that period until completion, have been part of that Newmont group for, say, just under a year. And I think it's testament to the values of their organisation, the way they've gone about their custodianship of Telfer and indeed Havron over, you know, let's call it 12 months.
Yeah.
They've taken an asset and improved it during their tenure.
Yeah.
You know, they are fantastic operators, but they've also been laser focused in delivering their strategy for Newmont shareholders. And that is this go-forward portfolio of 10 assets. Yeah, I think Tom Palmer has a formidable organisation, a great culture, and they've won gold. You know, the 10 assets that they have is just exceptional. You know, just couldn't speak highly enough of Newmont, but, you know, we can potentially come in and also create value for Greatland shareholders. So I really view this through the prism of being a win-win.
Yeah, I mean, the only other thing that I, you know, had a thoughts on is that when you announced the deal to UK investors anyway, most of us, you know, got maybe 2 hours notice to
to get through your sort of hundreds of pages long document. And it seems to me that it's a funny regulatory thing, right, where you're forced to put out this like massive amount of information, but you're not given enough time to read through it before you make a decision to take part in the deal at 4.8p.
Yeah, look, yeah, you know, we work within the UK platform. Yeah, you know, London is one of the great financial markets on the planet. And we've been successful within the structure of that regulatory market. So yeah, hopefully people view that really positively. Look, I think down in the Antipodes, yeah, we have this ASX platform, which has had to be able to attract capital from all over the world.
Yeah.
We have these trading halts for 2 days that allows announcement at the start. It allows people time to digest the information. Look, I'm used to that ASX Australian system, which I think actually helps and bring more shareholders more time to understand the asset and in this case, the transaction. We felt the more time people had with it, you know, the better they understood it, the more attractive it looked. Mm. But look, you know, couldn't be more complimentary of what we've been able to achieve in London, on the market there, the support we've had and the consistent support over the years. So for me, this is a celebration of what we could achieve in London. And I love the fact they're looking to reform that LSE market. But yeah, for me, that Australian or ASX system, which has to be so efficient to attract capital around the world, is a great template to look at. But it's so similar to the London listing and our Corporations Act. You know, London is the benchmark for the world. But yeah. I think, again, you know, some of the innovations or market mechanism in Australia work really well. And hopefully over time that might be viewed positively in the UK.
So, Sean, going back to Telfer, you in the documents that were saying that this 420,000 ounces of gold in a mine plan for 15 months, how much more can Telfer be extended?
Yeah, look, we obviously love the asset. You know, we acquired it. You know, perhaps how I'll describe this is, you know, during my time at Northern Star, we bought, I think, 5 assets from majors, Barrick and Newmont, most of which had a mine life of less than 12 months. All of those assets are still operating today, say 10 years later. And that is the opportunity. And that's why we're so attracted. These assets that are in majors are huge mineral endowments, and we want to reinvest. And at some stage, you know, and maybe this goes back to the comment about Newmont's divestment, even though Newmont could see further value at Telfer, they have this amazing suite of assets. And really, would Telfer be able to attract exploration capital, development capital within that portfolio? There were other priorities. And that's effectively why at some point these assets are better in the hands of a mid-cap. And this is it. Yeah, I think for Sight, they have not been the focus of a company probably since 2005. So, yeah, I hope the people that we're bringing into becoming Greatlandians once we complete this company, I hope they're really excited about that opportunity because – you know, we're in love with that site. We want to invest. We want to unlock. And it's these people at Sight. And it's an amazing team of people Newmont have. But they've got all this experience and time on that site. You know, we want to work with them. We want to work with the people who are excited about what can be achieved there to unlock the full potential of this asset. So it's exciting for us.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's exciting for all the people up at that site as well.
Yeah.
So I was looking at the overall highest gold producers in Australia, and it's just over 400,000 ounces, I think, per annum. So do you think it's possible, probable, whatever word you want to use, that between Telfer and Havieron, in terms of the 258,000 that is sort of written in stone as we speak at the minute, but reading between the lines, the Havieron figure could be accelerated, I'm assuming. But between those two, do you think you could be a 400,000, 500,000 ounce producer in the next 2 to 3 years?
Yeah, he's smiling. He's hesitating, but he's smiling, isn't he?
Smiling back.
I love the question, Kevin.
I can't answer it is the next statement.
Absolutely.
But look, we feel really positive about the future of this asset. We're excited about that future. And look, there's no substitute for us getting in there, completing the feasibility study, and we'll look at optimization opportunities at Havieron and will look at life extension opportunities at Telfer. And none of that is certain until we're able to deliver. But certainly, you know, part of the opportunity here with that really big infrastructure is the second largest gold processing capacity in Australia behind Cadia across in New South Wales. So the opportunity, if you do identify ore, the milling capacity, the processing capacity is, you know, tremendous there. So lots of opportunities. The option value around the potential here, I think, is significant.
Yeah. And the other thing was that I think it has to be a vote of confidence that Newmont want to take 20% and go on the ride with you. So, you know, it's basically turned around itself. You were the 30% and you were the one taking the ride. Now you're taking them for a ride in terms of they want some upside on this. Otherwise, there's no possibility they would have wanted 20% of your shareholder.
Look, in the same way, yeah, I think Newmont, you know, during a relatively brief tenure there, have been extraordinary custodians of that Telfer and Havieron asset base in the Paterson. I think a very important part of Newmont determining that it was comfortable doing entering a bilateral discussion with Greatland was the confidence we gave Newmont about our custodianship of this asset. And that's why I brought in what I think is, you know, an outstanding group of directors. I think an equally outstanding group of management team that have worked with me to deliver this transaction. And I'm hugely grateful to the effort of the team here, but also the financial credibility had and the effort we put in to enhance share register. All of that was to give a major, whether that was Newcrest or what eventually evolved into Newmont, confidence that Greatland was a preferred counterparty. And I think that's what we've achieved. And yeah, there was reverse due diligence. You know, Newmont wanted to understand more about Greatland, and we were able through that process to give them confidence to become a shareholder. I can't speak more highly of the team at Newmont or the relationship. So we're really looking forward to the future with Newmont and what we can achieve together. They're obviously going to focus on their stunning portfolio. But equally, Greatland laser focused on delivering value at Greatland and Havieron for its shareholders, including Newmont, I think creates value for both organisations.
So, Sean, my last question, and Charles ask a few questions as well. From the perspective of the land package that you've also got through here, through Telfer, and also the exploration upside that you had through all the other things that were already in Greatland Gold, are we looking at the next major that comes out of Australia?
Well, that would be something. Look, I think we'll have a package of 4,000 square kilometres. Yeah, that's a really meaningful package with two world-class endowments within that in terms of Havieron and Telfer. We've talked about the Paterson being elephant country together with Winu up in the north. You've got these, you know, huge discoveries that have happened. There's a cover sequence across there. So you don't have outcropping ore bodies. You've got to use geophysics to peer through that cover. And again, I think cover is our friend. It's a lot easier to explore when it's not there. But of course, a lot of that's a lot easier and a quicker cycle time to discovery. But as geophysics techniques continue to evolve and improve and the interpretation of the Paterson improves, there's more and more opportunity to find more, you know, really significant ore bodies. The metallogenesis of kind of Telfer and Havieron are the same. So there's no reason why there can't be more potentially, you know, really large manifestations out there. So look, the option value again from that, you know, really substantial portfolio, but then having the existing infrastructure to take advantage of it. And that was the original, you know, quite sensible rationale of entering a joint venture with Newcrest, because they held the keys to the mill. Now we do. We dominate that Paterson region. And I think that is incredibly exciting for what we can achieve across there. And yeah, we couldn't be in a better place.
I guess that means, you know, it's not just obviously you've got your massive exploratory tenure. If Antipa uncovers something amazing, if Artemis Resources, which is close by, uncovers something amazing, they're exactly in the same position as you were in the past. They'll want to use Telfer and you'll have that spare processing capacity. the ability to consolidate the entire region. You're the kingmakers almost, aren't you?
Well, look, you know, we certainly feel we have a really strong position. You know, we don't necessarily need additional ore with Havieron coming on with a 20-year mine life. I think we're in this luxurious position of having our own really clear, mining profile into the future. But if there's something sensible to do for Greatland shareholders, I think what we would like to do is be constructive with other participants in the Paterson. And we think we can do things that work well for both sets of shareholders should those opportunities arise. And, you know, Greatland is open for business. You know, that said, look, our immediate task is to have a successful integration, to deliver what we think is the potential for Havieron. And there's no relaxing our team about that. You know, we want to achieve that. That's what we need to do to create the value we think this transaction affords. So that's the immediate task. And although it's fun to think about what may lay ahead in the future, right now there's a very immediate task to hand.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you've got the bank debt letter of support, $750 million Australian, with ANZ, HSBC and ING Bank. I haven't seen the terms of that letter at all, but how long did it take you to negotiate that debt? Was that quite difficult, or were they throwing money at you?
Well, look, tier one banks for a tier one asset.
Yeah.
You know, those are the creme de la creme of, you know, resource banks. We're really, you know, really delighted to have the support of that group. Just to cast your mind back, Charles, gosh, it would be mid-2022 when Greatland just held that 30%. Those same three banks, ANZ, ING, HSBC, put in place a fully credit-approved $220 million seven-year project financing facility based on our 30% of Havieron.
Yeah.
So if you extrapolate out that $220 million, 30% to 100% ownership, that's a $733 million facility. It's now a $750 million facility, less complex because there's no joint venture elements to it, less complex because we're not toll treating all through that Telfer mill. We now own the Telfer mill. So this is relationships that I've had with those banks,
yeah,
in some case for decades.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they've been on the Greatland journey with us for the past 3 years. So we're really confident in that banking group. We're relationship bankers. Even though we had an opportunity and we probably had just about every bank in the world knock on our door in the last 6 months as speculation was in the market about Greatland's opportunity to acquire these assets, in the same way we appreciated the trust and the relationship they'd put in us, those three banks, to put that original facility in place, we wanted to repay that relationship by specifically taking those three banks forward. And look, at some point, we might bring some other banks in. It'll be a large facility just for three banks. But our starting platform is to honour those relationships. And I think, you know, we want to take that kind of relationship style and culture of Greatland. We want to be using that for mining contractors, for drilling contractors, you know, with all our relationships. And, you know, and it's no different in banking. So we're really pleased about that, but I think long-term strong banking commitments is good banking.
Well, with the independent assessment of Havieron back in the day, was it Grant Samuel, wasn't it, who did it for Newmont? And they were saying...
It was a Grant Samuel with the AMC technical component, yes.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, I looked at the fact that they're getting a massive report in mining. There are always massive reports. But they were talking about Havieron being worth sort of between $500 and $600 US million. And yet, based on the share prices of Greatland Gold, you know, it's worth significantly more a couple of years ago. And now this deal is valuing it at less. And so it's difficult, you know, for me as an analyst to say, okay, how much is this asset actually going to be worth in 2027 when it's going to throw off hundreds of millions of dollars and yet you've bought it for this amount? It just seems like an absolute steal. But you've done an incredible job.
Well, expert reports are about, you know, not what you think you know, but what you can prove. So, look, we're really comfortable with those reports. Well, certainly the report we compiled with SRK. Yeah, they're a really capable team. And I think that 15 months high confidence mine plan is a great starting position. But remember, there's now 30 million tons of stockpile at surface, a 9.6 million ton of high grade plus 20 million tons of low grade. There hasn't been a better time to own Telfer since 2005.
Mm.
It's lived hand to mouth for years, which is challenging for any operation. To now have that buffer, there's obviously an economic benefit of having stockpiles at surface where yeah. someone's already spent the mining cost. So those ounces become far more profitable than that when they would when you still have to dig them up. But what I actually celebrate even more than the economics of that 30 million ton stockpile is the operational contingency, the operational buffer that affords us. So look, really excited. And that's why it's such a good time to own it. We have the stockpiles. We have a US north of $2,500 gold price. Kevin asked that question around margin. Yeah, to be given the current gold price, to be operating at a plus US $1,000 an ounce, particularly over this volume, this leverage to the gold price, yeah, is exciting. So, you know, 426,000 of copper, gold or gold equivalent ounces is an amazing starting point.
Yeah, well, I think when I run the numbers, it came in at something like $479 million, which
yeah.
almost more than covers that $475 million deal. So I didn't, I was rubbing my eyes thinking, what am I missing here on this one?
This is what I've been saying the whole time, Phil, is what I'm asking him. And he just seems yeah. to have done some magic.
Yeah.
But the thing moving ahead, Sean, is, I mean, and again, it's me with the optimistic head on, but I'm looking at you becoming the top producer in Australia, say 400,000 ounces per annum in 26, 27, 28, wherever it happens to fall. At a current price of gold with a margin of 1,250, because Telfer's maybe more expensive than Havieron based on your all-in sustaining costs of 880 or thereabouts for Havieron. And you're talking about kicking off $500 to $600 million of free cash flow a year. And your current market cap is going to be around £550 million at the current price, which is 5.4p today. So well done. You don't have to answer.
Yeah, look, I think I'd encourage people to read the documentation. I think there's some mathematics in there that... And one, you know, and by the way, you added a bit to our cost. It's 818, so let's call it 820 US dollars. You added a bit too much there. But I think, yeah, look, we feel we're really well placed. We feel there's free cash flow generation, you know, US $1,000 a month an ounce. But you do have to subtract some head office costs, some exploration, CapEx from that. But look, the illustration of that is significant.
Yeah. No, I just want to capture, Sean, what shareholders and listeners can look forward to in the coming 6 months. Obviously, you've talked about gaining an ASX cross listing within the next 6 months. How is the company now going to have to pivot from being an exploration company to effectively a producer? Is it going to be applications for, you know, clean energy grants for Telfer? Just talk us through what listeners can expect in the coming months.
Look, we're really excited about the catalysts. You know, if I speak about them in the next 12 months, the ASX listing we think is really positive. It opens up to, you know, new shareholders, and the Australian market was hugely supportive around the transaction. Potentially we qualify for indexation, so passive investment funds buying on the ASX if we're ASX 300, say. Then you move into Telfer. We believe we'll come out with, you know, a meaningful JORC resource. We target that in the March quarter of next year, followed by a JORC reserve on Telfer, which would demonstrate mine life extension if available, which I think would give a lot of confidence to the market, we think is a major catalyst. Turning to Havieron, we come out with the feasibility study. We say in calendar 2025, Greatland shareholders would be aware it got delayed from, I think, Newcrest's public statement that they were going to do it in the December quarter of 2022, if memory serves correct. So that's been on the shelf for a long time in near final format now. You know, so we need to update that. There's some work that needs to be done. SRK reviewed that as part of their 20-year Havieron mine plan which was part of their report and independent assessment. So we're looking forward to finalizing that report. And we're looking forward. Remember, we've spent 3 years working on Havieron since I arrived. And we've brought in, you know, a tremendously talented technical team. So we've had 3 years of thought time about optimization work we can do on that. So we're going to do that. That work needs to be done to feasibility study standard. But if we think we can improve it and show the full potential of Havieron, that, if possible, what if we can deliver anything, would be a really good catalyst for growth. Then we move into 2026 when we start ore production. If we can extend that Telfer mine life, we don't have to operate for it like a junior where you put the first teaspoon of ore through that mill. We can actually stockpile. And then when we do switch into Havieron processing, we're doing it, you know, at meaningful volumes, getting good expected recoveries at better cost per unit of processing costs. We can do this in a really optimized way. And that's this confluence I spoke about of an existing cash flow and producing mining asset in Telfer with this 20-year mine life Havieron asset. It's a tremendous marriage in terms of what that does. And it all goes through a single mill. So over time, we'll really think about this just as the Telfer asset, which is fed by the Telfer open pit, the Telfer underground, and the Telfer and the Havieron underground, if all those mine lives can be extended so that they can keep pace for some period of time with what we can observe in the SRK report at Havieron.
Well, Sean, I think you've obviously been working your proverbial off over the last months, probably not just the last few weeks, but as you explained to us, you've been doing nearly 20-hour days for the last number of weeks. So enjoy. And yes, let's hope everything goes okay with the vote. I'm sure it will. And yeah, you've got a lot of work on your hands from now on because you're now managing director of a significantly bigger company.
Yeah, look, it's been hard to communicate as much as we want during this period, which has been an extended period of time. So I've been, you know, keen to get up to London and engage with shareholders, which I'll be doing very shortly, but certainly in the coming weeks. So, yeah, excited about that, excited to be able to share it with people, excited to be able to talk about this. But look, just to finish off with, just want to make people appreciate the dedication of the team here. You know, it's a relatively small group of people at Greatland that have delivered this. And you know, I couldn't ask for a more dedicated team. It's a privilege for me to kind of be out in front, but really people should have, you know, no mistake that, you know, doing something like this is a team effort. And you know, just profoundly grateful for the team I've brought together and their buy-in to want to deliver this, because everyone's made sacrifices. They haven't been able to spend time with their families, or they've had to, you know, miss events to execute this. And yeah, just want to be clear of how grateful I am for that.
Very good. Well, on that note, we'll say Sean Day, Managing Director of Greatland Gold, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Phil, Kevin and Charles. Just always good to connect. And yeah, look, got to celebrate the success, and hopefully, you know, the excitement of the team here is conveyed. I'm probably not running on as much sleep as normal, but hopefully that enthusiasm comes across, because yeah, this is wonderful.
Enjoy the barbie.
Thanks, guys. Thanks again.
Well, let's move on to our second guest this week. We're joined by Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources. Welcome back, Oliver.
Hey, how we doing, gents?
Yeah, well, good, thanks. So, yeah, I mean, obviously, since you've last been on the podcast, we've seen the news that the company provided an exploration update on the 100% owned Pilot Mountain project in Nevada. Key highlights include the discovery of two significant magnetic anomalies from inversion modelling, one at Porphyry West, which is larger at depth than previously identified targets, and another new north target coinciding with recent geophysical data. These findings suggest exciting potential for further exploration. Additionally, geochronological studies on the Porphyry South target indicate two episodes of hydrothermal mineralization between 86 and 88 million years ago, providing valuable context for ongoing exploration. So, Oliver, just explain the significance of these findings, because effectively you've done the magnetic, the airborne, and then now the inversion, and seen these four skarn deposits, which potentially indicate porphyry deposits.
Yeah, you nailed it there. So I think the biggest takeaway here is that, you know, the original hypothesis that we had when we acquired the project almost 4 years ago now was that there was a much bigger exploration story there. Really, the previous operators you know, rightfully so, they just drilled and explored what they could see at surface, which is what most historical work is. It's just whatever was poking out. But obviously modern day, we're looking a bit deeper and we're kind of now holistically viewing projects and saying, okay, is there more here than meets the eye? And that was our hypothesis. So the great thing about Pilot Mountain is the fact that we have what we believe to be the largest tungsten resource in the entire US at surface on our project. And we can push the development and the value with that particular deposit. But sort of in tandem with that and in parallel, we've been doing a lot of really important exploration that's never been done here. And each time we do more work, we're finding that the system is bigger and bigger, which is obviously a really exciting development and a good problem to have, a lot more exploration that we need to do here. So,
yeah. So, I mean, I saw your excellent technical explanation on the RNS in the week. You've obviously said that from these 3D models, you've identified that this west target is larger at depth. So what sort of work are you expecting to carry out to kind of define the scale of it going forward?
Yeah, of course. So just kind of how we got here, just to rewind this a little bit. So Porphyry South was the first magnetic target that we found. And as you mentioned there, you know, looking for porphyry mineralization, porphyry deposits is a huge part of what we're doing here. And just for sort of all the listeners' reference and understanding, if you have a skarn deposit, there has to be a porphyry. Just physically, technically, geologically, that's just how these skarns form. They form from porphyry deposits. So when you have four, you know, relatively closely spaced skarn deposits at surface, and no operator has gone in there and actually looked for the causative porphyry, is what we call it. Well, there's a huge opportunity there. So Porphyry South was the first magnetic target that we uncovered with ground magnetics. And then we started to look at, you know, step back further and further. And sure enough, we expanded the magnetic surveys to the west and found what is now the Porphyry West target, which to our excitement is actually quite a bit bigger than the Porphyry South target. And on top of that, the inversions, what they do is they sort of take a 2D model, turn it into a 3D. The inversions show that it's, you know, it sounds a little bit cliched, but it literally looks like the tip of an iceberg. The magnetic anomaly sort of, you know, crescendo, or not crescendos, but sort of coalesce at surface. But as you go down, that magnetic anomaly gets bigger and bigger at depth. And then just in addition to that, we've now found another magnetic target called the North Target. Probably need to come up with a better name for it. But that's another target that coincides with a really strong chargeability anomaly that we found. So some really exciting exploration targets. Where do we go from here? The data just came in and we just sort of got hold of it about a week ago here. And obviously drilling is ongoing across the property right now. So we're very diligently and quickly working behind the scenes to figure out where we go from here. But we've also talked about the fact that we're doing some updated amendments to our drill permit, which will allow us to drill holes into all of these targets. So everything's moving forward in tandem. And yeah, good, exciting results that further bolster our, you know, our kind of overall view of the project, which is fantastic.
So, Oliver, we have basically, we have an iceberg, as you said, so it's going down. I think we discussed that the last time as well, that is the way that it could be. So the North Target obviously should be called the Titanic Target, without doubt, you know, because one may collide into the other. But looking back, May 10th, 2023, listed Pilot Mountain, tungsten, silver. Now we have porphyries. Now we also have a cat on the other side of the equation as well, which has got porphyries that you've proved has porphyries. We don't know what necessarily the mineralization is. And you've got gold thunder, I think, as well, still to go and have a look at. So just give people who don't know the story about GMET, just give them an overview of what's happened.
Yeah, so I think first and foremost, we are a strategic metal explorer and developer. Really the main value driver right now, and I think the main reason why people are having a look at us is the fact that we own what's believed to be the largest tungsten deposit on U.S. soil. So that right there, I think, is a huge selling point. Reason being, there's, you know, a whole list of reasons, but I think one that really has me excited right now is the fact that China has banned the exports of antimony to the U.S. And that's really sent shockwaves through the antimony industry. And the reason that this is important for us is, number one, antimony and tungsten are sort of the key military metals right now. They're used in the manufacturing of ammunition. And on top of that, there's a lot of speculation now as to what the next metal that China could ban the exports of. And all of the consensus that I've seen is that it's tungsten. Now, whether or not they actually do ban the exports of tungsten, I think really those sort of key highlights effectively highlight the value proposition here at Pilot Mountain, because what's happened in the antimony space is there's not many antimony players, and a lot of capital and money has flown into U.S. antimony projects. So if China does ban the exports, while we are the only publicly traded U.S. focused tungsten name that exists, so obviously that puts us in a really unique position. So the tungsten focus is our main value driver right now. But as we've discussed with the extra work we've done at Mound and the cat that you mentioned, Kevin, which is our other property, Garfield, mm-hmm. we're not just sort of a boring development story, just pushing forward what is a really exciting tungsten deposit. But in tandem with that, you get exposure to some really exciting blue sky exploration is what I would describe it as. So it's a really nice balance. You get the sort of the baseline valuation associated with our tungsten deposit, but also you get exposure to all the really exciting exploration work we're doing at Pilot Mountain, looking for the causative porphyries. Garfield, as you mentioned, where we've taken that project from literally three claims to, I think, north of about 80 now, multiple drilled copper gold porphyry targets. And then you also mentioned Golconda, really high-grade gold at surface that has never had a fair shake. So there's a lot to look forward here. And if you like strategic metals, if you like defense metals, especially in the US, which is the country that's really leading the charge here, well, we're the only show in town, really.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're talking about export bans from China. It was graphite and then a couple of rare earths, so germanium and gallium, antimony now. I mean, I've been saying tungsten is going to get an export ban for a year and a half, and people didn't believe me. They're listening now, finally. They're a bit late. And I guess, I mean, the other part of the story in terms of the strategic nature is potential grant funding from the US Defense Department and various other departments. Now, we know that you were putting applications in kind of the middle of last year. As a general rule, it takes about 12 months for these to get granted or refused. And we're now kind of well over that 12-month mark, which to me suggests either, you know, there's very good news coming shortly, or maybe better news than what people were thinking. Can you comment on that at all?
Yeah, what I can say...
No, he can't say anything.
He can say it.
Stop asking questions you know he can't answer. Well, it's going to come when it comes. Relax.
I can comment just sort of high level. You know, we very openly put out an RNS around, I think, Q3 of 2024, as you mentioned, highlighting the fact that, you know, one of the key things we're focused on, in addition to the exploration, the drilling and development, is tapping into non-dilutive grant funding. And that money is real. The DPA 3 program, I encourage everyone to just Google DPA Title 3 and see all of the fantastic grants that they have given to U.S. domestic miners, explorers. Most of the metals they're focused on being a Department of Defense department or subsection of the DOD is they're looking for defense metals. So antimony, I mentioned before, Perpetua Resources, which is probably the most important antimony explorer in the U.S., received two grants for each $30 million U.S. dollars from the DPA3 program. So the money, what I can say is the money is very real. It's now almost every couple of weeks now, they're granting further DPA3 funds. A lot of it goes to downstream producers of various defense metals, but I'd say probably half of it is going to explorers and developers. So we think we're in a very unique position, but obviously I can't comment on anything specific to us until we have announced anything related to that. But the money is real. And based on what I kind of said before, you know, we're the only U.S. tungsten explorer developer of size, so that I think that should highlight the position that we're in here and how it relates to potential grant funding.
Wonderful. That was a very well done political answer. It could have come straight from the mouth of any member of parliament. Yeah. Now you're on your flagship assets. Like, something that I'm not a geologist, but something that I've speculated on in the past is that what you actually have when you're talking about multiple porphyry systems, you actually just have one massive interlinked system across the properties. And I think now, you know, potentially you're more comfortable saying that might be a possibility.
Yeah, no, of course. So that's one thing we're looking at right now is now that we've discovered all these additional systems and would look to be sort of these clustered or causative porphyries, it turns to how does this all connect up? Sort of putting the puzzle together, so to say. So when you have, the important thing just to note here is that, you know, we dated the porphyries now, I think it's about 88 million years, plus or minus a bit. But effectively, that means that those mineralized bodies were in place 88 million years ago. And Nevada notoriously is an area that has been chopped up and faulted and ground to pieces over those 88 million years. So what that means is that there's been a lot of geological time for things to sort of fault away, move, tectonic activity. That's why these deposits form, is because of all this movement. But also it means that certain deposits can be faulted and move certain distances. So with that in mind, and with the systems that we've now found, we're now trying to piece it all back together. And we put out an RNS a few weeks ago, I think it was, which had actually the first sort of schematic diagram we've ever produced, which ties together Porphyry South and Porphyry West. And you'll see in that diagram that there's sort of a inferred fault there that effectively would allow these two mineralized bodies to be originally part of the same body. So what that means is that it's one big system. Now, we talked about the fact that we need to do more work to really dial that in, but it's certainly a possibility. I mean, the reality is here, the four skarns at surface are all almost identical in terms of the alteration, the mineralization.
Exactly, right. Yeah.
The porphyry alteration we're seeing at surface is very, very similar across the property. So it points to the fact that this could be one big system, and that's just, it's sort of been dissected and faulted a little bit, but everything, as far as we can tell, is contained within our property. So it's just a matter of doing all the work, the fun geological work, to piece everything back together. Once again, a really good problem to have, I would say.
So, Oliver, just from the point of view of silver and garnet, copper, as opposed to tungsten, what do we have at Pilot Mountain, just so people can understand a bit more about Pilot Mountain?
Yeah, of course. So, you know, it's the resource that we have right now. It's tungsten, copper, silver, and zinc. The majority, if you look at sort of an in-situ metal value, the majority of the value is hosted within tungsten. It is a tungsten-first project. So if you want exposure to tungsten, James, Guardian Metal, that's what we're doing. We're a tungsten company. But obviously, we don't ignore the fact that, you know, there is significant copper, silver, and zinc credits associated with the tungsten. So it's sort of a 60% tungsten, you just break it down on in situ, and then the other 40% is sort of split between copper, silver, and zinc, which is great because it does give us exposure to an increase in any of those metal prices, all which have done exceedingly well, I would say, over the last couple of years, or at least since the resource was published. But then you also mentioned there, Kevin, and importantly, the garnet as well. So we've talked about the garnet a little bit. We've sent a bulk sample for analysis, but the main mineralized zones, being a skarn deposit, there's significant garnet, visual garnet associated with that mineralized zone. And we've sort of quantified what that could look like, but we need to do the work now to actually hammer that out. But just really quickly, the importance, or what could be the importance of the garnet, is that could be another potential revenue stream down the line. And also on top of that, not just the revenue stream, but also the way that it would fit into the flow sheet. If the results prove what we hope they will, that garnet gets moved out or gets extracted from the process quite early on. So it's less wear and tear on your grinding circuits, but also it's another recoverable and sellable product, which would be industrial garnets used for things like abrasive blasting. So we're looking into that right now, but tungsten, copper, silver, zinc, garnet, some molybdenum as well. And actually there's
historically... Try to say that fast again.
Don't make me do it. And then also there's some historical reports and things that were published by the previous owner, which mentioned gold potential as well. So another thing that we're going to look into here is if there's gold associated with the system as well.
And on top of that, interesting, you mentioned the previous people had said that they anticipated from their studies that there was 2 to 3 times the amount of tungsten available on other assets, which you've now obviously started drilling. And you've started drilling and you've now come up with porphyries coming out of every porphyry, basically. So tell us, when are we going to know the drilling results? Are we going to get excited next week, the week after, and I mean, I know it's going to go on for quite a number of months because there's been drilling and there is still drilling, but give us an idea of the year-term things.
For sure, timelines. Yeah. So obviously, you know, I can't say too much until we put out the sort of initial results. The last release we put out with the drilling update, we had 18 holes completed. And the way it works is that every hole we drill, within a week, typically that rock is in the lab. So that clock kind of starts. So what that means is that there's going to be continuous news flow. We're still drilling right now. So that means that for the next however long, there's going to be more rock going through the lab. So what that means is that there's a lot of samples and assays for us to report. And when it comes to when sort of the first batch of results will be available, we did mention, I believe last week, that we have sort of all the results in hand for the first batch. So what that means is that I take that data now, or that's what we've been working on, QA/QCing that data, interpreting that data, preparing all the documents. You know, there's a lot that goes into publishing drilling results. You have to take your time. You have to do it right. There's a lot of spreadsheets that I'm currently working on right now. So all I can say is that the first batch is in hand, and obviously we're working through that at pace. So we'll announce that to the market really as soon as we can.
Okay. So what you're saying is the first results are imminent. And I mean, I think for anybody who's listening who hasn't really heard GMAP before, I think we're going to get some grant result this year, I'm pretty sure. Whether positive or negative is obviously up to the grant, though on slides that we did see, and I don't think it's public knowledge, so it's not saying out of the question, it did state on the website that you were one of the chosen few. Whether that actually comes to fruition of cash, I don't know. But yeah, there are so many opportunities here. The porphyry style deposits here could be huge. There could be, you know, tier one type metallic content in terms of tungsten, which is going to be required, copper, silver, garnet, all those things. And Garfield is another very exciting thing, which we haven't really got time to talk about. But yeah, I mean, there is a lot of potential here. And you really are at the bottom of the Lassonde curve. And good luck.
Right on. Well, I appreciate the time, gents. As you mentioned there, Kev, a lot to look forward to, not only technically with upcoming drill results and ongoing drill results as we continue this program, but also commercial updates as well. And, you know, we're watching news out of China quite closely, and there's a lot of speculation, as I mentioned, that tungsten could be next. But either way, you know, the need to reshore and onshore defense metal supply chains back to the U.S. is now. And we strongly believe that we're going to be part of the solution for tungsten, which is really important, and we're looking forward to doing that.
Good. Well, on that note, we'll say Oliver Friesen, CEO of Guardian Metal Resources. Thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks, gents.
Now on to our third guest this week. We're joined by Sapan Guy, CCO of Sovereign Metals. Welcome back, Sapan.
Hi, Phil. Good to be back.
Absolutely. How's things?
Yeah, good. Look, we are busy at Kasia, which is Sovereign's rutile graphite project in Malawi. We're in this optimization phase, which is basically the part where we try and understand how this thing is going to get mined, processed, and sold in the best possible, lowest risk fashion. Yeah, so the guys are busy on the ground, and as you've probably seen from a lot of our news recently, we've all been gunning in the right direction for a successful outcome at Kasia.
Very good. Yeah, I mean, obviously, the latest news we saw was where Sovereign confirmed that its Kasia graphite concentrate is an excellent feedstock for high-quality battery anode materials, with electrochemical tests showing strong performance and positioning Kasia as a cost-competitive premium source of natural graphite for lithium-ion batteries outside of China. Just talk us through, I know we've seen obviously a few RNSs in the past about all the different test work that went in Germany in particular, but just talk us through how significant these results are and really what it means going forward for the Kasia project.
Yeah, the first thing is, if you find graphite in the ground, it doesn't necessarily mean that graphite is going to work in a lithium-ion battery. The way it's expected to work for your Teslas, for your Fords, for, you know, your BYDs even, there's a lot of work that happens between what's in the ground and what's in the battery. And what we've been concentrating on, at least on the graphite side, is what's known as product qualification. It's basically qualifying our product for use within the batteries. So the first step we took was, well, can we mine it in an efficient manner? Can we then process it in a way to produce a graphite concentrate? Can that concentrate be floated and produce high levels of flake, natural flake graphite? Can that graphite be purified? Can it then be spheronized, which is basically the scientific word for, can those flakes of graphite turn into balls of graphite? Can they then be coated in pitch, put in a battery, and does that battery charge and discharge the way you want it to? And, you know, the last four or five RNSs have basically pointed in the direction of Kasia's graphite can do exactly those steps and not just come out at the other end as in line with market, but actually surpasses a lot of the market's specifications.
So you've got great balls of graphite is what you're telling us.
We've got great flakes at the moment.
Okay. But you're going to have great balls of graphite, which will be even better. Right, Sapan. For all those that don't know, tell us the story behind the largest titanium dioxide resource in the entire world and the second largest graphite resource in the entire world.
Okay, so the history of sovereign metals is back in 2016-ish, the then CEO geologist by the name of Julian Stevens was convinced that there's very good quality flake graphite in Malawi. So he went out there, did a lot of drilling, a lot of testing. By the end of 2018, we had a PFS on a graphite-only project, a nice project that's still there within a different company now. But while some of the engineers were doing some sample test work and some metallurgy on that project, every time they wanted to produce a graphite concentrate, they found a lot of titanium in the waste product. And so we started asking the question, well, you know, titanium occurs really in nature in two forms, ilmenite, which is about 30 to 50% titanium dioxide and sells for about $200-$300 a ton today, or very scarcely do you find rutile, which is about 95% plus titanium dioxide, so near enough finished product, and sells in the market for, you know, $1,500 plus. The answer to the question, well, what kind of titanium have we found, was rutile. So then we answered this, we tried to get the answers to the second question, which you've got to ask when you find these types of deposits: is that rutile a commercial product? Right? Is it saleable? Is there too much uranium in there? Is there too much alumina in there? Is there too much chromium in there, which makes it absolutely worthless to your future potential clients? So we did a lot of work on that, and we came back that actually the rutile that we've found sitting around in Malawi is of premium specifications. I mean, we were hitting 96, 97, 98% TiO2, no critical impurities, absolutely usable by the end markets to produce titanium metal, titanium pigment, titanium sponge, and for the welding market. So then we took a step back and we said, okay, let's find out how much of this we actually have, right? And we started that process as this could be a nice byproduct to our then graphite project. Turns out we had just hit the tip of this huge iceberg of rutile. So we spent...
Not another iceberg. We had an iceberg in the last podcast as well.
They all had media training, Gavin. Don't talk about icebergs.
They've all had media training. And from what you're telling me, the area that you find is the size of Manchester, wasn't it? Greater Manchester.
Oh, look, yeah. So it's 200.
So is Ten Hag managing it, or has he decided on somebody else?
Let's not go there today.
Let me try to be professional. He just breaks down mid-interview.
Carry on.
Look, I would back the management of Sovereign over the management of Manchester United right now. Look, so what did we find? We found this huge rutile deposit, first ever rutile dominant deposit of its kind found in over 70 years, the largest of its kind. I mean, we're at least 2.5 times bigger than the second largest. And the really nice thing is that graphite mineralization carried on within the rutile that we found. So we've got the world's largest rutile deposit, but it's also the world's second largest flake graphite deposit all in one.
So mine's bigger than yours is what you're trying to say.
That's absolutely what I'm...
Once you realize that, Rio Tinto decided they wanted a piece of the action, didn't they?
Yeah, so Rio Tinto are very big in titanium dioxide, titanium feedstock. They mine very little rutile. They mine that ilmenite, which I talked about. They mine that in South Africa as well as in Madagascar. And what they do with that is then they essentially smelt it into something that is close to a substitute for rutile. Now, why isn't everyone just using rutile? Because it's absolutely scarce, right? I mean, only 5%, maybe tops 8% of all titanium feedstock comes from rutile, because we just don't find enough of it. The only the two major sources of rutile that we had before Sovereign came along, was Sierra Rutile in Sierra Leone, and the byproduct of rutile from Base Resources Kwale project. Now Kwale runs out of reserves in a few months, and Sierra Rutile is actually not producing at the moment. So that gives you an indication of what the supply for rutile looks like.
So, Sapan, the cost effectiveness of the potential way, or not potential now because you started to do it, of mining this is what, and how, from a environmental point of view, is this going to be positive for both the world and Malawi itself?
So I'll answer that question by first just telling you about how that rutile and graphite sits. This is not a typical hard rock deposit. It's not a mine where you need to drill and blast it into smaller rocks, which then you crush and grind down into something that is potentially processable. This is what's known as soft friable material. It's a material called saprolite, which is essentially, to you and me, it's essentially soil. And it goes down to about 30 meters. And so that rutile and the graphite is not chemically bonded to one another or anything else within that soil. The rutile sits as discrete crystals. The graphite sit as discrete flakes. All we're doing is washing away everything in that soil that we don't need, i.e. everything that's not rutile or graphite, taking that rutile and graphite out, putting the rest of it back where it belongs. And it's as simple as that. And because it's that simple, we're basically, our objective is not to just to be the largest producer of rutile and graphite in the world, but the lowest cost producer of both those minerals.
I think you're pointing at me. Yeah, I mean, okay, so we've got the largest rutile deposit in the world. We've got the second largest natural plate graphite deposit in the world. I'm guessing, you know, when I first looked at Sovereign Metals just over a year ago, the graphite was potentially the risk factor. And now, having got these test results back, it's pretty much as de-risked as it can be now. Obviously, you're still doing an analysis of the graphite. You're still doing more analysis of the rutile. But you have this pilot plant operation, and that's on the verge of being completed as well, isn't it, Sapan?
Yeah. So we had a spiral concentrator delivered to a facility in Lilongwe, which is capital of Malawi. A few weeks ago, the boys are busy basically constructing, installing that into the processing flow sheet, and you'll hopefully hear about that in the next few days or weeks. Once that starts getting commissioned with material that's coming from our test pit that we've mined recently.
Good. Well, it's always good to have you on and listen to these, you know, talk to you about the projects and get, you know, frequent updates. And obviously, Kevin and I are going to try and aim to get down to Malawi to Kasia and actually see it for ourselves, and obviously see the scale of the pilot plant. Because one thing that I don't think a lot of listeners can really grasp is just how big that pilot plant is, right, Sapan?
Yeah, go on our social media, go and read our announcements. They all have very good images of what that test pit, that pilot plant, all looks like. People tell me it's probably the size of a lot of other companies' main project. Yet, you know, we look at it and it's 5% of our kind of full-scale operations. So you can get a feel for just how big Kasia as an operation is going to be.
Very good. On that note, we'll say Sapan Guy, CCO of Sovereign Metals, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, so let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers. I mean, Greatland Gold, obviously, we just talked to Sean. Not going to dwell too much on that news. Obviously, that was a big news story of the week. Charles, give us your thoughts on the Centamin announcement that was around the beginning of the week.
Well, I think the big story to understand is that that the gold price is at record highs, like 2,580, 90. And it keeps rising because interest rates are probably going to fall. And this demand for gold, you know, among central banks is sort of record-breaking month after month. And so Centamin is, you know, plodding along, generating its gold. And one of the key things of, like, major gold producers is that they tend to track the gold price, but a couple of years behind it. So when, you know, Ashanti comes along and goes, right, we're going to buy Centamin because a couple of years from now, you know, it's going to explode. But even if it doesn't, it doesn't matter because what you can sell the gold they're mining for is going to make a massive amount of money. Now, obviously, it's even though it was at a decent premium, it's not at sort of Centamin's, you know, share price high from the past. But this is a decent deal. And what it's telling you, you know, if you're an investor, is, okay, what other companies could be approached with a buyout deal at this kind of level? Now, there's plenty there could be. I noticed, you know, today, for example, that other than Greatland, obviously, you've got Greatland news. But Amarok Minerals, they're going for first gold next quarter. A mineral resource upgrade is on the way. The photos they're sending of the visible gold mineralization that they're going to be targeting is fantastic. But Endeavour, on, you know, at a larger scale, further along the pipeline, they just uh, They've got commercial production at the expansion they've had and at Lafigue. And so you're looking at, and Greatland as well, you're looking at the situation where these kind of gold miners, they're not majors, but they're kind of mid-tier or going to be mid-tier producers, are going to make a massive amount of money and be really, really attractive for merger and acquisition. On Greatland, you know, we just spoke to Sean. There are a few companies around the Greatland portfolio now that Greatland has Telfer, which will be, you know, actively engaging with Sean, possibly after he's had a long nap. But Antipa, obviously, but you know, the other one that was on my mind was Artemis, you know, and they've got rocket samples that broke the Stay Lab scale. Now, a lot of these companies are capital light, but have good assets and got good early exploration. So that's another thing you should be keeping an eye on. What are they going to do around there? But the basic thing is, the difference between the all-in sustaining costs of a lot of these miners and the $2,500 plus price of gold is just so drastic that they're so profitable. They're all going to print money. What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, I think gold is hot topic, isn't it, right now? I mean, it's, as you say, it almost seems like every day it's busting through the all-time highs. The Centamin deal, I was trying to look at the value of that. I think the deal valued the company at about £1.9 billion or sort of circa $2.5 billion. And the offer from Ashanti was some 32 or 36% above the closing price the previous day. I don't know. I mean, do you think that was a good deal for the asset there and the company?
It's tricky. I mean, I don't think it was a good deal. But then the problem is that you never know all of the information, right? You never know exactly what's going on behind closed doors. And they might feel that, you know, for example, AngloGold Ashanti comes in with its expertise, potentially they can generate more value out of the assets that they have. But I don't know. I mean, what do you think? I think
the gold production from Sukari, because it's in Egypt here, obviously, it reached 450,000 ounces in 2023. You know, so if we go back to the scenario with Greatland, it puts it in perspective. This has been valued at 1.9 billion in sterling with 450 ounces of production in Egypt, with 5.3 to 5.8 million ounces of reserves. You know, the scenario is that should Greatland in 2 or 3 years' time be worth at least that? Because we're saying, is that really a good deal? Well, this maybe only has a mine life of somewhere in the region of 10 years left. Maybe there's extensions to come. I don't know enough about it. But, you know, when you put it in that perspective, then you see what a great deal Greatland gold probably really is.
It's got more gold resource. It will be able to get up to the similar kind of annual production, if not more, and it's in a better jurisdiction.
Yeah.
I know. But this is why I was saying to Sean, like, he's done this incredible deal. It almost seems too good to be true.
So, yeah. And Sukari's probably all in sustaining costs is probably pretty low as well because of where it is as well in Egypt. But at the same time, they also do have to give a fair amount of productivity, I think, over to the Egyptian government. But I don't quite know how that works either. But yeah, but all I'm trying to say is that it puts it in the same ballpark of what Greatland could be worth. Yep. You know, who says Greatland's not actually a takeover target for one of the majors now that has all of this scenario? And if it can, you know, the whole of that area can then suddenly become Greatland territory. You know, it's a very interesting play going forward anyway, as far as I can see.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, we're talking about like Antipa or Artemis, you know, there's dozens of operators out there. But because of the free cash flow that Greatland is going to be throwing off, they'll be able to buy anything that they want, and they'll be the natural buyer because they have Telfer. So all of the exploration that not only Greatland is doing, but other companies are doing around them is exploration for Greatland in effect, just with a premium attached, which, you know, is also really exciting and something I think a lot of people will start to catch wind of.
Yeah. Absolutely, no doubt. Gold is going to be the story. I still think we're going to have a copper story. You know, copper's cooled off to around the $9,000 per ton mark, but I still think we're going to have a run on that. There's going to be a shortage on it. It's silver also has got to have its day in the sun as well, as far as I can see, because I just don't see the difference now between silver and gold in terms of the ratio is going up and up and up all the time. It's like 86 now, is it? Something like that.
Yeah.
So this historically is always bounces back to 130, 1 in 40, 1 in 50. which would mean that, you know, Klopp could double or treble easily, even with the same gold price now.
So let's move on to a couple of other RNSs this week, which have been highlights. We had Celadon Pharma, who had obviously announced a strategic collaboration with the Danish company Valeos. And we obviously already, we interviewed Jim in the week, and that we encourage you to listen to the midweek takeaway. So we talk at length with Jim about the details and the placing, etc. There was also news from Power Metal Resources, heads of terms with Elara Resources and Altad Copper.
I think the two power, there was two RNSs for power, both very interesting prospects in terms of what's happening in Saudi Arabia with their things. I spoke to Sean briefly this week, and hopefully we're going to get him on in the not too distant future, because on Friday was the last day for the uranium deal to be signed as well. He was still very hopeful everything was going to be sorted out. So I think watch this space for power metals over the next week, and we'll be getting Sean on and going through all the news that has been Power Metal Resources. Obviously, GMET is a big part of that as well. So, yeah, it's very, very interesting times for power metals, and I think got to see an uptick from here. Got to. It's crazy, crazy valuation.
Okay, so on that note, I think we've talked long enough. It's been an action-packed show. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe, hit the bell icon so you get any notifications of any future episodes. And just say once again, thanks for listening.
Thanks, guys.
Cheers, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.